why did Jesus die? Who killed him? When was it planned? These kinds of things are major questions. And so to actually take from us today to set up what we can brainstorm about what are the issues behind the cross, and then tomorrow we'll look at how traditional theologians of the Christian tradition from zero to today have interpreted the cross and its meaning, and the variations on that theme. Because you could say, isn't this simple? Doesn't the cross have one meaning? Don't we interpret it as Christians this way? But what we can see in looking at this history is actually the cross has been interpreted so many ways for so many reasons across 2,000 years. So we'll look at some of that history and how they've answered the questions we'll look at today, how some of these founding thinkers. Wednesday, we'll start in on some of the feminist both critiques and appreciation of atonement theory, the cross as a symbol, as well as how Lutheran feminist theologians have incorporated, either appreciated or not appreciated, Luther's theology of the cross and that conversation. So looking at that's Thursday. Wednesday, okay, today, tomorrow, traditional theologies and kind of how they've answered our same questions. Wednesday, we look at black theology, black liberation theology emerging in the late 1960s especially, and then how womanist theologians, after that, black women theologians have taken that theology and incorporated it today, and some of the critiques and some of the appreciations of the cross. Thursday, we're focusing on feminist critiques and appreciations of the cross in multiple ways, including Luther's theology. And then Friday, we'll talk about what seems to be the pressing concern of theology today is theology and empire, this concern about the cross and its use in supporting imperialistic, nationalistic empire. And that, if you go and look at new books in theology, new books in religion, that theme of how is our faith connected to imperialism is all over the place. If it's got empire in the title, it's a hot seller right now. That is the kind of what's in vogue as our hot topic, it seems like, if you look at the publications that are going on. And actually, Rita Nakashima Brock and Rebecca M. Parker's latest book also deals with that. Let's look here at this image, and what I'm going to ask you to do, if you can see it, can you get some vague semblance of what this looks like?
Is it out of focus?
To me, maybe to me.
If not, feel free to come up here too. You can get up and move. You don't need to sit in your chair. So feel free to come up. Let's look at it silently a couple minutes. I can tell you first, I'll introduce it briefly. This is, if you can imagine, an enormous painting, actually about this size, done by, it's entitled Women of the Cross by an artist named Anne Ownby. It's done in pointillism, tiny little points of paint. And it's in an enormous gold gilded thick frame. She painted it to be like an icon. And if you could take a look at it, here are the questions that I want you to consider. What would you say is the main message of the painting? How is the cross depicted? And what does it mean? So what's the main message? How's the cross depicted? What does the cross mean here? What do you take? Right in the middle. Thank you.
Means a lot of different things to a lot of different people.
Yes. Yes.
They're all women.
Because this popcorn wants to just speak out or think about it.
Let's take a minute just to look at it. we'll leave it up here too while we're talking, but what are some of the things that come to mind as to what it might mean? So I have heard already that it would mean a lot of different things for a lot of different people. Actually, I have this in my office, and I love having it there in my office because people come in and they give this huge variety of responses to it, from vast appreciation to anger and all kinds of things. So what are some of the things that you see here?
Jesus died for all of the people, including all the women of various colors and various occupations or connections to the church.
Great.
I see stereotypical portrayals, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, a lot of titles and commercials and so on. Things we have made into idols.
Oh. Things we've made into idols through commercialism. And a lot of stereotypical images, and then also, I don't want to just tell me if I'm repeating you incorrectly, but you might be able to hear me better since I'm facing this way. And then also that Jesus died for all women of all occupations and all kinds of connections to the church.
The image that the cross... women are burned at the cross. So when the cross is destructive of women.
Mm-hmm. The cross is destructive of women.
We continue to crucify.
Crucifixions continue. And we continue to crucify, so important. All right, other.
And across all time. I mean, these represent a wide range of time.
And it seems to represent different, beyond Christian women.
Mm-hmm.
Others.
Can you hear people? So I don't. Should I repeat? Okay.
The vulnerability of arms wide.
Huh.
But by the same token, if the arms are nailed to the cross, there's no sense of enfolding those in front of the cross. So there's a separation between the people on the cross and the people looking at the cross.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Other responses or thoughts in this. That's just either the main message or...
I guess I can't see facial expression from where I'm sitting.
Yes.
And I that would be very telling, to see it. Maybe others can see that.
I do have... I photocopied. I did some black and white photocopies if you want to pick one up.
Oh, okay.
Afterwards, you can see the face a little bit better. It's also somewhere... in the middle of, I had suggested this as the cover for Cross Examinations, and I think Fortress Press thought it was too controversial. So I kept changing it. I thought, oh, it's so, captivating to me, and they said, well, we'll stick it at the beginning of the introduction. Well, we're going to put it in the middle. It kind of ended up next to my chapter. My chapter isn't necessarily about this, but it was kind of funny how I kept moving around. I was like, okay, as long as it's in there somewhere, I think it's a good image. Yeah.
It gives the impression of bondage. Especially the centering.
Mm-hmm. Bondage, kind of the thicker rope. And you can see she's actually the Native American woman, I believe, is the only one who's looking down in the picture. The rest of them are looking forward. I'm sorry.
Isn't the center one, isn't that a sail? Well, I personally like it's an African being sailed to America.
I was going to mention that along with some of the other images in the background are do I see mountains or cities in the upper left?
Ah.
And the flames, is that like Joan of Arc?
Mm-hmm.
And the one in the lower left, mm-hmm, doesn't have a cross really of wood, it's of lightnings,
mm-hmm,
or rainbows or something.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't even look, she looks like a cartoon figure, not a real person.
Mm-hmm.
I get Celtic out of that one.
Oh, down below on the left.
Mm-hmm. I got like Jesus Christ Superstar.
And it could, the rainbow, I can't remember what Anne Ownby meant by the rainbow, whether it was a connection to the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender women. Could be another kind of symbol there. And I wouldn't be surprised if that was there, but I don't think it's, you know, like we're finding lots of different things. Other kinds of thoughts, yeah.
The middle left one, I see. How do we crucify women who are struggling with their bodily identities?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she is so skinny and so naked.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty different kind of, it's, I've always thought, I've looked at that and thought the Barbie of the cross, you know?
Yeah, and also so blonde.
And so blonde.
And how our culture kind of demands that of certain types of people.
Yeah.
I see a lot of sacrifice in these images.
Yeah.
That's the message I've
heard. Them sacrificing, them being sacrificed, or just all kinds of versions of
maybe
sacrifice.
Maybe both, but I guess most of presently is the sacrifices there maybe.
Uh-huh. Yeah, isn't, you know, I haven't thought of that before, but in a way it's like it could be either the sacrifice of Jesus for all the women, it could be these women's sacrifice that they make in multiple ways, you know, either culturally or out of love and out of caring, you know, and it could be a positive image of sacrifice. It could be, you know, them being sacrificed and burned at the cross. We've kind of covered lots of different interpretations there. Well, let's keep this up for a moment. The reason I wanted to start with this is, and to talk about how and why the cross might be such, when I'm saying a hot topic in theology today, why that might be so. And there are three main reasons in looking at, I think, why this ferment around the cross in the topic of Christianity. One is, like, National Geographic has something that said, you know, the last 100 years were, they called it the century of suffering. And you could say, and we do say, well, everyone has suffered across, you know, the millennia. But they made the point that actually 50 million people were systematically murdered in the 20th century, making it the bloodiest century of any century. We didn't have the technology to achieve that prior to then. So looking at that, and especially out of our own Lutheran tradition, World War II, what do you do, how do you understand God's presence in extreme suffering? The German theologians post-World War II, most notably and famously Jürgen Moltmann, struggled with this question of how am I to understand this vast suffering. His response, and one that influenced Latin American liberation theology and a lot of theologies around the world, was that God chooses to join us out of love in our suffering. And so the image of the cross for him primarily was picking up this motif of saying it shows God's condescension into the world, coming down into the world and joining us in suffering, and it's the only way we can even understand God's presence in the middle of this horrendous, these horrendous events. That kind of image was so powerful that in Latin America, a lot of people took Jürgen Moltmann's book, The Crucified God, that he wrote, and built it into their own Latin American liberation theologies, which surrounded their struggles against oppression and injustice and murder. And so you had, Moltmann tells the story of saying that in one kind of gruesome slaughter of seven priests, that he went to visit the site of where these Jesuit priests had been slaughtered and laid out on the lawn of the church to show what happens when you kind of protest against the government. And in the case memorializing this at the site was his book, The Crucified God, with blood of one of the priests still on it. It's under glass and it's there. And the priests had been reading that. And he said, so that's one of the crucified God with the blood of the priests who were killed is there right at the site of where this happened. So obviously this kind of, his theology has meant a great deal to people around the world and internationally. An appreciation for how we understand the cross and why it's so central to Christianity. Others have picked this up. Douglas John Hall, The Cross in Our Context, is one of the books I put in the bookstore. He also talks about, he takes more of a look at empire, but a very appreciative look at what the how the cross is a positive symbol in Christianity, especially in dealing with suffering and dealing with empire, things like this, what it can do. And we'll talk about that more on Friday. In 1990, on the flip side of the conversation and setting this up, in the early 1990s, 1993, there was a reimagining conference in Minneapolis where a number of feminist, womanist, black women theologians, Mujerista, Latin American women theologians, Asian American feminist theologians, women gathered together, had a lot of major speakers come and talk. And Dolores Williams is an African American theologian who was invited to speak. And she had written on the topic before, but her talk, in some ways, I think symbolizes a very different response to the cross. She had stated in her talk that for African American women who have had their lives defined by surrogacy, by suffering for others, not out of their choice, not out of volition, but being made to suffer for others, that this is such a destructive symbol. She actually, within this, we'll look at her argument on Wednesday and how she builds the statement in, but the thing that got in the newspapers was that she said women, particularly black women, don't need any more bloody Jesuses on the cross. She said this is nothing but destructive for women, the message that it has, and especially women who have had an experience of suffering, of violation, of kind of forced suffering, and then kind of have been told to think about that as redemptive, that suffering is actually redeeming. And she said, we cannot have that message anymore in Christianity. The cross is not, she said, you know, it's a God of life. It's a God of resurrection who demands life, not glorifying death. So let's get over it, people, in a way. And of course, there were quotes that were taken out of context. And so it really sounded, the quote, like, we don't need any more bloody Jesuses, did not sound like the conference was up to any good. So there was this big reaction. What are these women talking about? What do you mean you don't need the cross? And so, but these two sides of things, I think, have been developing, of looking at how does this symbol function for women and how destructive it could be, and this very strong appreciation of the of how the cross speaks to suffering. So our century of suffering is one thing. What I've already talked about is the factors why the cross is important right now. This century of suffering we've been in and trying to interpret it, both World War II, Latin American struggles for liberation, continued suffering and looking at this. Then you have the voice from feminist and womanist theology coming along and challenging the positive imagery behind the cross. And for Lutherans, I think this is highly pressing because we do have the cross as so central to us. A lot of Luther's writing on the theology of the cross, law and gospel, have some dynamics to them that actually in the feminist and womanist perspectives could be seen as abusive, frankly. So I think as a Lutheran feminist theologian, that's the intersection I grapple with, of saying, how does our own theology perpetuate, and does it perpetuate kind of abusive kind of cycles when it comes to women? And is there a better way to go about it? And then last, what I talked about, another influence is this concern about, or kind of continuous concern about empire and Christianity's association holding hands with the powers of empire throughout history. And I can say in theology, probably Constantine in 312 at the Milvian Bridge, the first time, at least symbolically, the cross is used to take up this symbol and forge ahead into battle. And Constantine, who wasn't necessarily religious prior to this time, presumably, the story goes, has the cross painted on all the shields of the warriors, and they go into battle with the cross, and they beat their enemy down to a bloody pulp. They win the battle. Constantine takes on Christianity, and from then on, this idea of Christianity being used as the cross being used as a weapon of empire and of conquest. This is one of these major concerns or questions coming up now, but what I would say about that is I personally find it interesting that in a way, Constantine, everyone hates Constantine right now. All these theologians are so mad at Constantine for wrecking Christianity. Like, it was perfect before 300. And then Constantine came along, and now look at it. It's like, it's just so, it's almost comical. It's starting, in a way, to become comical to me, because it's like, it's not even the devil anymore. It's like, Constantine wrecked it. He's the biggest bad guy in theology right now. And probably for very good reasons. But what I find interesting, and what I haven't answered yet, is why are we obsessed with this question? Why is American theology or North American theology totally obsessed with this question of Christianity and empire? What are we worried about? What are we seeing? And why is this the...
history repeating itself.
Yeah, either history repeating itself or the fall of our own. I don't know what's going on, but something's happening with this question. So in looking at all of this, that's kind of a long introduction there. But we'll go back to the cross, and what I'm going to do here is ask us to think about, brainstorm today, on some of the key questions that I talked about earlier, and also just the symbol of the cross, what it means, what it can mean historically in pop culture, things like that, and that's where we'll start. And we can turn on the lights. I can leave... Does this turn on the last question?
No, just those three.
Just these three?
Yeah, that's
all
enough.
All right. Dangerous after breakfast to turn off the light. I don't know, I'll fall asleep.
No, we just had a coffee break.
Oh, good. That's right. All right, so just the symbol. Let's think about this. Is at the beginning of Jürgen Moltmann's essay, I had asked him to contribute something on looking back at the crucified God and what he his importance on that, and then what he thinks about it now. He offered that, but he also said, "I want another essay in the book." Okay, that's interesting. Like, the only one to have two is him, because he didn't want to be put down, I think, as an appreciator of the cross in all contexts. So his second one is about the cross, and particularly how Nazi Germany used the cross as a tool of imperialism, and his own kind of response to that and his fears about today. So that kind of flip side. What were you going to say, Christian?
No, I was just commenting.
Yeah. So he wants to do both. I thought, oh, that's interesting. I wanted to pigeonhole him as, the appreciator of, the cross, and he insisted on having this other one in here. But in this context, it's truly awful. Yeah.
I've always just been curious, studying the history of things and how did the cross, how did the cross become our central image?
Mm-hmm.
If it's Easter that is our primary and predominant festival,
mm-hmm.
and people will say, well, it's the empty cross, and I'll say, well, yeah, but it's still the cross.
Yeah.
It's not the empty tomb. How did that piece all lodge itself? I mean, Jewish faith has the six-pointed star, Islam has the crescent moon, the star, and we have the cross.
Yeah, where does this come
from?
What
do we do?
Well, the one thing, The Saving Paradise, the subtitle of their book is How Christianity Traded Love of This World for Crucifixion and Empire. And what they do is it's kind of a fat book, and they've got lots of things in here. The argument that Brock and Parker are trying to make is that prior to, actually when I heard them talk years ago, and I thought, I haven't made my way through that whole book. It just came out this summer, a month ago. So, but she had said that prior to public executions becoming common in the Middle Ages, that the cross was not the central symbol, that it was baptismal imagery that dominated Christian art as the central. But then when we get public executions and the importance, and then the Reformation actually kind of backed this kind of substitutionary atonement cross image, then they say this kind of builds into that this becomes the one thing. And I can say that other people, other church historians and art historians, however, have said, well, I'll be interested to hear how they prove it. You know, what they're using to prove that kind of thesis. It's a pretty strong thesis, right? And so, or a pretty bold and big thesis. So
I think it's demonstrably false, too. I mean, the cross
yeah.
has been at the tops of steeples for as long as we've had steeples.
Yes, and it has been, well, and it'll be interesting to take a look back, you know, and look at their argument. But yes, even early on, theologians, you know, in the 300 theologians, at least, I could say, in looking at theology, they're also focusing on the cross some, not only on baptismal imagery as central, so even as early as 300. But it's a pretty interesting, they look back to say, like, is the, their main introduction even says, we went looking for the cross, like the women of the tomb. It really sounds like the women looking for the body, you know? And they're going all over the video, you know, ancient art to see the depictions of Jesus on the cross, and what they say is, we couldn't find the body anywhere. We couldn't find him. And so they thought, what is going on? And so this idea of, was there a different emphasis on baptism and paradise that's carried out in this imagery rather than the more central motif of the cross? But I think that's still, you know.
But isn't there also reference to Jesus himself about making up the cross? And so even before the crucifixion, it was seen as Christianity is your cross to bear because not everyone's going to like it. Persecuted, and this is your cross to bear.
Take
your cross up and join me.
Yes, it's not like it's not in scripture anymore.
Right.
Yeah. In looking at the symbol today, if you were to think of just the cross symbol, and this doesn't have to be your own interpretation or meaning, it's just any meaning that you see out there. What does the cross mean today in any context you can think of? Multiple contexts. And you know, profane, meaning non-sacred imagery to anything else, yeah.
Mine is a non-sacred imagery.
Okay.
It always kind of surprised me to go with my teenage daughters to places like Claire's, which is in every mall.
Uh-huh.
It's the teenage cheap jewelry store, and there are crosses, all us crosses in Claire's. And
what do you think
pop,
it means?
As pop jewelry.
Yeah, what does it mean as pop jewelry?
I don't know, because I can't separate how I feel about the cross. I have no idea.
Yeah.
I've always been a Christian, so I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It would be interesting to find out what people who are, you know, young women, girls, even girls, aren't shop at Claire's anymore. What they're saying with that. Don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, any other thoughts on that first, of what it could possibly mean there? The other place it shows up is rap. Rap music, there's big honking crosses on a lot of those rappers that are out there. I mean, lots of them. And that's been kind of interesting when I say, oh, I'm writing on the cross. And this person who works in an inner city said, oh, that has lots of different meanings around, you know, where I'm at, you know, as far as prostitution and all kinds of, the prostitutes wear crosses. I mean, it, you know, they're wearing the crosses and lots of people. So it shows up in rap music, Claire's Boutique, you know, the all kinds of things. Other things that the cross means, yes.
Presence of Jesus.
Yeah. All right.
Torture.
Yeah, torture and death.
Yeah, you think about the images that came out of Abu Ghraib that looked like a crucifixion.
Mm. Or Matthew Shepard.
Yeah.
I think that was Matthew Shepard, the gay man who was strung up on the barbed wire. I think lots of people said this was a crucifixion type. Torture, death, other things.
Persecution.
Persecution. Other things.
Organized religion.
Aha, uh-huh, yeah.
God's gift.
A sharing of pain.
A sharing of pain.
Statement of faith.
Mm-hmm.
Some Baptists, it's an idol.
Uh-huh. That my ecologist Forrester, who said that
no.
Death is vital.
No, actually.
Okay, was that right? Death is vital.
No, idol.
Idol.
Some people think it's an idol.
Oh, death as idol.
No, the cross as an idol.
Ah, okay.
Death is bigger among have any cross in their church because they still like to worship.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Right. Okay.
My daughter, when she was about 2 years old, we'd be driving through
country, and she would see an intersection sign, and she would point and she would say, "Daddy Booking."
Daddy what?
Daddy Booking, because she would see an intersection.
Oh, that was amazing.
I learned later
that.
What's that?
Like a clergy symbol?
Well, no, well, yeah, because that's, you know, Daddy's working there. But I learned later that the Celts had a symbol long before, and it was the circle of the universe being held together, or the intersection of the divine and so. That was a positive way of looking at it.
Yeah, and even when I think of Daddy working, someone had even said, well, they've been crossing on churches, right, from the beginning. So the fact each church an identifier. Hope. And you.
Now, isn't there something also ancient about time and space and eternity meeting in the middle or something?
Mm-hmm. Kind of ancient. It's in our own country, the burning crosses, lawns have been, racial hatred, intimidation.
Cross is symbolism of child abuse.
All right. And do you want to say more on that? Or no?
Well, that Jesus is the Son of God, being killed on the cross,
yeah,
validates child abuse.
Uh-huh.
Only if you misunderstand.
Well, I wasn't asked to.
Right. And also, the nice thing about these brainstorm sessions is you can bring up ideas that aren't yours. So you can always throw out whatever idea. It doesn't have to be your own interpretation or your own answers to any of the questions we'll do today. And the work that we do on this, I'm going to keep bringing back so that we see, because we ourselves will come up with all the reasons that all these theologians have dealt with these questions in multiple ways. Thank you.
If we could go back to the idol one.
Yes.
Some churches, it has to do with worship, death on the cross. They feel they shouldn't have a cross in their church because it becomes a symbol of what they're worshiping rather than Jesus.
Yes.
They feel like it's a substitute for Jesus.
Yes. There's even, that even is a, well, that's a profound church issue right now. Churches that don't want crosses for a variety of reasons.
Yeah.
They don't want them up front. They don't want them... either for because we don't want it all to be about suffering, which you could say is a prosperity gospel, that God really is about making money and success, that the prosperity gospel has been big into remove the crosses. And what's interesting is they're about remove the crosses, and maybe Rita Nakashima Brock, Rebecca Ann Parker, and Dolores Williams would be all for it, but for very different reasons. They'd say, sure, we don't like it either. And then there's those like Jürgen Moltmann, Deanna Thompson, Douglas John Holler, who are saying, actually, the cross needs to be there for Christianity because it talks about, it doesn't allow us to be this glorified religion, about pretty things and lots of money and stuff. And so keep the cross, So there's a fight over whether it's even there. It's predominantly there, but there's some fight about it. Yes.
I don't see redemption on there yet.
Yeah. We can even put it up high.
Well, it's just the prosperity churches think of the cross as a downer.
Yeah, it's a downer. It is a downer, right? Yeah.
Of hope.
Hope.
Hope for the life after death, God's kingdom, no evil, no suffering.
Yeah. Something, so. There's more hope for lots of different things. You had your hand.
Western ideology.
All right. And by that,
I mean, just sort of the differentiation between the Muslim world, the Western, there's sort of this, regardless of whether you are Christian or not, it sort of represents that whole Western civilization ideology of what is it.
Yeah, and you can't even get, in that kind of thing, we can't separate out economics, politics, and religion, right?
Right.
It all
right.
ends up
it
being
comes
carried
together
in this big wad.
Right.
Maybe that's why it declares.
Yeah, that's why it declares?
Yeah.
It could be. Okay.
No.
Oh, that's interesting. All right, wait a minute. Let's see. I want to write that down before we lose that. Okay. economics. Not, and we'll remember it's about Claire's. And religion.
The cross as an industry.
Industry. All right. A couple more hands.
I remember traveling in the Middle East when I would, you know, see a cross on a building, I'd think, oh, there's my people.
Yeah.
So it's comfort in a way.
Yeah. Can I put that under this identifier?
In places, sure. In places where Christians are a minority, it's a comfort thing.
Yeah. In a not an imperialistic,
right.
But a comfort thing. Right. Yeah. And you can do that.
I was just thinking about the cross. Usually there's only one person on the cross. I haven't seen multiple people nailed to a cross. Although when Pam and I were in Japan, the 26 martyrs from Japan were marched from Tokyo down to Nagasaki, crucified upside down. And I didn't know about the, you know, the on the cross, not together, but 26 individual crosses, because they were Christian. And I just wonder about the, you know, the cross being upright, or the cross being inverted. But then also just the sense of the, like, the hope, the new life, the cross is empty in most cases, as we see it.
I'll just say one thing, because the image I have, actually, my favorite image of the cross is the El Salvadoran art with all of the pieces that make up the cross. And so for me, that symbol is a symbol of compassion, of compassion, suffering with that Jesus suffered with us.
And we have that in the worship center, right?
Yes.
That with the scenes of scenes of life, this demand and a way for life. We are the people of the cross, and we demand life rather than oppression and death. So that kind of, that will be my answer. I'll put it down.
Is the Granlund sculpture still at PLU in the library where the cross is made up of people?
Yes, and I've seen the cross made up of flames, flowers, people, villages.
What I remember, when I graduated in 85, it was at the entrance to the library, and it was Christ was bearing this cross, which was made up of images.
No, this isn't familiar to me. And I spent a lot of time in the library, so I will go back and look, make sure I'm not just
the title of it was the burden.
I don't think. Oh, okay, the burden. Okay, one more hand. We'll move on to our next
tree of life.
Tree of life. Okay. All right. Great. So, the symbol itself, what Moltmann says at the beginning of one of his chapters, he says, in the beginning there are two crosses. There's the symbol of the cross, and then there's the interpretation, the theological interpretations of what the cross means. And there, the question that I'll start with there, to get this, I think, will help us illustrate the variety of responses throughout Christian history. So first we think, well, all Christians think this about the cross. But if we look at just the question, and this again doesn't need to be your own response to it, but why did Jesus die? Give me some answers, and let's start writing them down. Of all the answers you can think of, why did Jesus die?
Because
all right. Take away our sin.
All right.
There's a man. He's a real person.
Uh-huh.
He told unacceptable truths.
He was politically incorrect.
All right. Let's see. He told.
To build on that, because he's human, and because he was human, he had to die in order to become God.
Or God had to die to become human.
Yes.
Human.
It was an interesting quote in from one of the Marcus Ford books. He quoted Desmond Tutu as saying, "When I on the political part," he said, "on the political part of Jesus." And I think Marcus Ford would say probably died because he was political. But he said that Desmond Tutu, the quote was, when I fed people, they called me a saint. When I asked why there were so many hungry people, why there were so many poor people, they called me a communist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the whole justice thing of Jesus, that was just very unpopular.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not saying it's a done deal, but it's one of the ways.
Challenge religious theology.
Yeah.
Or religious leaders.
Perhaps some will say economic or politics.
Yeah, challenge the intersection of religion, politics, and economics.
Mm-hmm.
First, he torqued out all the religious leaders,
mm-hmm.
factions that otherwise disagree with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then he torqued off the Roman Empire. And then he torqued off the people who were hoping he'd overthrow those things and put them in power by saying it's not about power. So they didn't stick up for him when...
Right. So there's all those kind of...
Yeah, he's pretty systematically torqued everybody off.
I don't know how it... Torqued you like the wrench, I guess. No, I've never been torqued on the
so he, and so he therefore became a victim of all human sin, and in that sense died for our sins.
Yeah, I know, Frank. I just don't think it. Let's take.
Yes,
you
it is
a,
like the wrench.
So we can like go beyond the veil and have a better relationship with God.
Okay, so can you say the veil for you?
So we can go beyond the veil, like I was trying to say, and so we don't have to have sacrifice and things like that.
Could you say that again, Mark?
Yes. There are a couple ideas in there that I want to put down here, that we can have a direct relationship with God, that we don't have sacrifices.
We don't have to have sacrifices to like this one person. We can, he was the ultimate sacrifice. The God provided for us.
Okay. Direct beyond. All right. Does that cover it? Couple.
I think it was in the same Martin's book, but he commented that he said crucifixion is one of the ways of dying that you cannot do to yourself. Somebody has to do it to you. So it's not just that he died. He didn't just say, "I'm doing this for you," and step off the cliff.
Someone killed him.
Someone had to actively.
Because someone killed him. I think what you're saying is more profound, but it is.
Boiling it down.
It is boiling it down. But someone killed him. Someone is to blame, right? Someone did it. And that's what we'll do, the whodunit next. Okay.
It was necessary for him to further the gift of love because it had to be through spirit, not through a human body.
Further.
The body's too limited.
Okay. All right. Other things we want to see up here before we move on. First back here.
To bring reconciliation and healing.
Okay. All right. And Chris?
An answer I don't really like, but is common,
mm-hmm.
to satisfy God's anger.
Mm-hmm. Anger, disappointment. Mm-hmm. Connected to that is because God decided to do it.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. We're moving on to who did it.
No, wait. I think to satisfy humans.
All right.
It's like a primitive
blood,
eye for an eye. You know, it's like this primitive thing that we have to have some sort of sacrifice.
Uh huh. Okay.
I think it's a more human thing.
There's a whole. There's a whole group around René Girard's theory of sociology and how violence and a cyclical thing built into kind of human nature, and a whole group of people who kind of study his work
And they had said, oh, you should come talk. I think you're really doing a lot of Girardian stuff. I thought, well, that's unconscious. You know, I didn't really mean to be working with Girard. But their whole thing is that at least S. Mark Keim, who provides a great answer, I think, contemporarily, said in a contemporary setting, says that they're picking up on Girard's idea of the cyclical necessity of violence and sacrifice in human culture, that Jesus enters into it to stop it, and that God enters into the cycle of violence to put an end to it. So kind of tying this back into wherever we have, so we don't need sacrifices anymore. Two more hands. Yes.
Well, behind the fact that Jesus died is the fact that Him being perfect and how to take on all the sins.
Yeah.
So, because He became a full submit to God's side, but He created to die, so He could look on us with grace.
Yeah. A perfect offering, perfect offering, meriting, substitutionary atonement, substitute. Perfect, perfect substitute. Mm-hmm. Perfect love.
Mine was actually really tied into that.
Okay.
And there's something about it that makes my skin crawl, but this idea of a perfect sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
But in the sense that, you know, He has to pay the price for all of the crap that we've done.
Mm-hmm.
And that it, not because He's doing it out of love, but because He's trying to make the balance so that God will accept us again.
Yeah.
How do you put that into it?
Yeah.
But it does have to do with substitution. Someone has to pay the price.
Yeah. Someone has to pay the price for all of this. And restore justice in some way. This has to be dealt with. Someone has to pay the price for violence.
This ties to the previous comment, but I would like to return to the section on symbolism,
yes.
Where the cross serves as an image of guilt and shame, arguing that human beings are corrupt and vile, and that this is what human nature has done to God, the bloody
mm-hmm.
Jesus image.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
and I want to add, and we wonder why there's a new theology of glory. I mean, just sit here and feel what the intensity of this.
Yeah.
Why are we going, la, 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 la,
I know, and I told Chris that I think why this all started percolating was not only theology classes, but I think I was horrified in like pastoral care and counseling with women class when they said this is the thing that stuck in my head, was the most common phrase in emergency rooms across the country from people who suffer domestic violence is, this is my cross to bear. And in a way, that idea of someone has to pay the price.
Yeah.
It's a big, violent, ugly mess. My family's a big wreck, and someone's got to pay the price, and I guess it's me. And they go back, because there is this image of redemptive suffering, and someone's got to pay for this. And actually, that kind of language is used in abusive cycles. It's your fault. This is why this is happening to you, is because you made it happen to you. Because you're so bad, and look what you've done to all of us. And you have to pay, you know. Rebecca Ann Parker, I think the part that makes my skin crawl is in reading there, she says, you know, this little kid watching their mother being killed, you know, by her father, saying, well, mommy was so bad, that daddy had to kill her. You know, and it was like, you know, you just think how horribly perverse some of the stuff is. But so it has these great positive things in the symbols and these great ways it gets so perverted in different contexts. In looking at who we went, someone had tossed out, and that was my next question for you. We've got just a little bit of time here. Who killed him?
I did.
Okay. Should I put your name up here? Yes, you could say yes, actually. Right. We did. It's an individual, and it's more as when I, and actually I will put, I did, because I think there is something to that. Were you there? Who did it? I did it. It's in a lot of hymns as well, profound lens of hymns. It's me.
There was nobody who stuck up for him.
Okay. All right. He was isolated. He was.
For everyone.
Which symbolizes all of our isolation and the ultimate dysfunction caused by sin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The isolation, the abandonment.
Historically, it's been, you know, there's the Jews killed him.
Yeah.
Jews are the Christ killers, which misses the point because it was the Romans who pounded the nails.
But God ultimately killed him.
All right.
Or did God allow Christ to be crucified?
I'm just doing that. I feel that was pretty
easy. Oh, no. Jesus.
Okay, just a minute. Allow this to happen.
But why?
That's tomorrow.
Jesus provoked everyone to kill him.
Yeah, but those who he disappointed or who misunderstood him. I don't know how to say that.
He also had nobody around him. It is true that he provoked other people to kill him. It's really mean in a way. It's like, oh, or not. You know, this is the whole fascinating with Judas too, right now. Judas, bad guy, good guy. What happened with Judas? You know, this question of, is he really the most faithful of followers, like the last temptation of Christ? And this last year, what was it that came out that had Judas as the...
The gospel of Judas.
Yeah. I'm looking at him as the most faithful disciple who's willing to kill him, who's willing to offer him up in a way where the other ones won't go follow through with the plan, where Jesus needs someone to follow through with the plan. And when Kazantzakis wrote The Last Temptation of Christ, that was called a heresy, you know, with the idea that Judas, that Jesus relied on Judas and said, you've got to help me. No one else will do it. And that was like, whoops, you know, Scorsese, and you've got this, that William Defoe playing Jesus. It's all kind of weird, you know, and so everyone got mad about it, but it's kind of interesting. So either Jesus killing himself, and that is a whole different view of, I mean, I haven't heard anybody go there. What I'm thinking about hearing, I learn a lot in these sessions. I haven't heard anyone talk about what this might mean for our approach to suicide. Redemptive suicide? Do we want to say that?
No.
So, and just doesn't
say anything? He did stab. They asked him questions, and he stood, and he didn't answer them clearly.
He's passive.
Right. Well, so, I mean, it's like he could have had a chance, maybe, to they would have let him go.
And where is it in John's gospel? He says, no one takes it from me, I lay it down.
Okay. Is he passive or active?
Is self-sacrifice divine sense?
Yes, it's self-sacrifice divine.
But then the angry mob came in.
They did. All right, angry mob. Anyone else we're missing here?
Institution.
All right.
Pontius Pilate.
Religious.
All right.
Those who feared him and feared truth and standing up to popular beliefs.
Okay. Anyone else?
We just seem to be awfully fixated on trying to find someone to blame.
Yeah.
You know, you're asking a question.
Yes.
And it's usually someone else.
Although you started off with,
right.
I did.
Yes. It seems to me like the greater question is, who didn't stop it?
Okay.
Because I think that's what...
So everyone
everybody in the world is asking, who will stop it? And they're looking to God to stop it. And I think that's the question.
How about, and I'll throw out, since we are running out of time, we haven't put the devil up here yet. But the devil is a... Jesus is in the cross, and honestly, when we look at even tomorrow, we'll walk through traditional theologies.
I know. Who is it, Constantine?
Retroactively, come back in time and kill Jesus too. He's so bad. He's so bad. And then he used him too.
Constantine. I think one of the points
about Jesus killing himself is the fact that he could have stopped at any time, but he chose not.
Yes. So we're dealing with this whole question of is he passive or active? It's a self-sacrifice, that kind of question, going back to that. In looking at these, and by the devil, we'll talk about even how this idea, C.S. Lewis, if you've read his the Narnia book, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, it's clear that there's a trick here being played, that God and the devil are in this exchange, and the devil takes Jesus, kills him, but doesn't know that it, in a way, like, and others then, back in Origen, early on in theology and beyond, early on in theology, carried this idea of Jesus is kind of the bait with the fish hook in it, set out, the devil kills Jesus, not knowing at the same time that it's getting, that the devil is getting caught on the bait to undo it, undo the devil. So certainly the devil did do it. God did it, we did it, the Jews did it, Romans did it. How we answer this these questions of why did Jesus die and who did it have everything to do with how we construct our own theologies. Your own personal answers to these questions. Also, if we toss in there, and we can look at it, I'll bring these back. Why did he have to die? Was it necessary?
Was it preordained?
Was it preordained? Is a big question. Some of these people, we would have to say, you might go toward it's preordained and it was necessary in some way. If you have these answers, to take away our sin, to be this kind of, it was planned before it ever happened. But if it truly is the Romans, the Jews, and the angry mob, not just being used by God as tools to carry out God's own intention, but if they had really a volition and they could have not killed him, that changes it. You can't really say it was preordained and hold. This is what I find fascinating about these questions. If I want to say he was killed because he torqued off the institution, well, then who killed him? Was it necessary? Not really. In that, if you only go with that answer, right? That answer leads to the next answer. The people killed him. Was it necessary? No. Not, or it wasn't preordained from the beginning of time that this had to happen. So that's another question for us in your own thinking. How do you answer this? Why did Jesus die? Who killed him? Do you have to die? And was it planned from the beginning of time? Or was it something that unfolded as his life occurred? And all of these answers will take you very different places theologically. But one thing about theology is we like to have one answer here, another answer here, and another answer here, and then when we're asked to make the logical connections, like, I think the mob killed him in the Romans and he was really politically incorrect. But I think it was planned from all of time because God needed it to occur. These things I don't think go together, people. You can't always have all these cards in your deck. You get to choose. But you won't make, I mean, if you want to hold them all, you won't make any sense. In a way, it's like these different cards or different answers, and we can start tomorrow. I'll bring these back, and we'll quickly go over your own thoughts and responses to, did he have to die? Was it necessary? And when was it decided Jesus would die? Was it Pilate? Was it before, at the beginning of creation? For whom is the death ultimately effective? And by that, like, who needs it? What's satisfied by it? So is it God's anger? Is it the devil's dominion? Is it our sin that's the price? For whom is it necessary? For whom is it effective? Will be the other question. We'll start with your own ideas on. And then we'll pull up the old dogs, and we'll look at their ideas. The predominant responses in Christian theology to these questions, and we'll look at them and ask the same question. If we look at Anselm, who did it? Was it necessary? And one of the things that J. Denny Weaver points out is at some point at 1000, in the 11th century, the devil was deleted from atonement. It was there before, the devil was there before, and then people deleted him theologically from the atonement, and it became either God or us who did it. And the reason they took the devil out was because they didn't want to make the devil so powerful. And because if God needs to pay the devil for something, then who's really in charge here? It gives the devil way too much credence, power, and dominion, and God doesn't need to pay the devil anything. Anselm found that reprehensible, you know, to God's sovereignty and God's power and love. So he says it is not the devil, that he takes the devil out of the whole question, the theological question. And since then, one last comment, and then thank you for all of your insights. I'll bring back these tomorrow and come up.
Tying in with that idea about the devil is, you know, we believe in the triune God, the Holy Spirit, God, and Jesus are one.
Mm-hmm.
And if you believe that, this is where you're talking about cards.
Yeah.
You're picking that. Well, I believe in the triune God. Well, then, I'm sorry, but the day that Jesus died, God died.
Yes.
And the devil was in charge for that small period of time, and then there was the victory. That's scary, too, to think about. But how can you hold these different cards?
Yeah, and my five-year-old, out of nowhere, and I'm not pumping her full of these questions. We're not talking about this at home over dinner. She came up with, she said, Mama, when Jesus died, did all of God die? And I was like, that's a really good question. Great question. Lots of people have answered that different ways. Lots of conversation around that. And, then she just kind of said, well, it doesn't matter. Like, during Easter week, I'll just pray to God instead of Jesus. You know, like, he's gone. Like, good plan. You know, oh, my God. Good plan. We move on. You're picking up on a lot of things that I wouldn't think about. But these, so I thought, well, that's interesting. She's fine.
I think the apples fall far from the tree.
Yeah, I don't know. It falls far from the tree. Have a good rest of the day.
I'm going to go to the next one.
Okay, Meredith Charleston.